Welcome, everyone, to the Goals to Podcast, where we take you behind the scenes with guests of all shades and styles to hear enriching stories about their lives, their victories, their failures, their dreams. I'm Humphrey Hawksley, your host for the duration, and today we're talking purpose, passion, and grit. Please enjoy, and to find out more, check us out on www.goalster.co.uk. And without further ado, let us begin. Hello and welcome. I am Humphrey Hawksley, your host for the next hour on Goals to Purpose, Passion and Grit, where today we are discussing something that in one way or another does or will impact all our lives. We're told by politicians and the media that social care is in crisis. How can we look after our loved ones who are vulnerable, particularly those who have special needs and disabilities? My guest today has been on a mission to transform social care. He is not a politician, nor is he a social worker, nor did he ever envisage himself doing what he is doing now. The story we're about to hear is uplifting, it's very personal, and it's also one that, in my view, every professional and politician involved in social care should listen to. It began when his daughter Laura was 6 months old, and doctors told the family, "Your daughter is mentally handicapped. She might live or might not. We don't really know. And by the way, good luck." To pick up on that story, welcome Paul de Savary to Goals to Purpose, Passion and Grit.
Thanks, Humphrey. I like the good luck bit because actually that's what my daughter over the years has brought us. Good luck.
Tell us about Laura.
Well, Laura was, she was born premature. My wife, Anne, had a difficult pregnancy. She was always slightly small. And then at 6 months, she got pneumonia. And we took her into hospital, which was a fairly sort of traumatic period for 3 nights. And then when we came to collect her, the pediatrician basically said what you said was, "By the way, do you know your daughter is mentally handicapped?" And so on. Wow, that was not what we expected when we went to pick up our bundle of joy. And really, since that time, she's affected our lives without us really realizing it. You know, this idea that something you think is perfect in a different way, sort of neurodiverse way, which we wouldn't have known that type of technology, terminology in the past. And really, it was, if you like, fighting that sort of label that she had that has really set us on a path where now as a family, with my son Hugo, we all work for her. That's 40-odd years on.
So Laura's what now, in her early 40s, is she?
Yeah, she's 44. A bundle of joy and challenge.
And tell us as much as you can what her abilities or special needs are.
Well, Laura's quite confusing. She has physical disabilities or around very complex scoliosis. She is very challenging because she's very bright, but in an incredibly narrow way, to the extent that she can focus on something. And if that something is a member of staff who's supporting her or is us as a member of family, you know, she'll just go at it and go at it and go at it. And I think we decided a long, long time ago that Laura needed to have her freedom away from us because we were being very reactive, you know, trying to sort of survive the complications of having a very complex person. Individual with child with learning disabilities. And so at the age of about 16, she went to a residential school, and that started this whole process of us understanding that she needed her own life, and we certainly needed our life as well.
So tell us a bit about the period between that, you learning about it when she was 6 months old, being devastated by what you had, until she was 16, that she was a little girl growing up in a family with a brother, the parents and a brother. Is that right?
Yeah, they're correct. I think the first sort of 3-4 years were very much around, we don't accept what we're being told here. You know, they've got it wrong. So you're in a sense of denial, and you're determined to prove them, the system, everybody wrong. But of course, the underlying issue is the underlying issue, but what the outcome can be is can be very variable. And certainly in our daughter's case, I think we achieved one heck of a lot of her potential, because we didn't accept that this bundle of complexity was going to end up being somebody who might live, somebody who might not, you know, might not live, because she had a fantastically sort of strong life sense about life force about her. But it was, we were very fortunate when she went to her first sort of school. And the head teacher there sort of said, we said, look, our son had been there, said, would you take Laura? And she said, absolutely. She said, it's really important that Laura comes, because she will come into contact with a lot of other kids will come into contact with Laura, and they will remember Laura, and Laura will have an effect on them during their life. You know, they won't forget that fact. And, you know, accordingly, Laura went there, and she was slow. She was way behind. But it didn't matter, because she learned some really great social skills and ability to talk and reason things up to a point.
So she went and was accepted, embraced in a mainstream school. Is that right?
This was a small private nursery school.
Okay.
Yeah. So we were very fortunate that we could actually find such a place where our son had gone. In fact, actually, I remember one day she came back and she said to Anne, she said, "Oh, so we had a visitor today, and they came in a large car, and they were taken around, and I met this person, and actually it was Princess Diana, who subsequently sent her own children to the same school, nursery school. So that was a great moment, actually. Yeah.
And give us where were you living? Were you in Lincoln, where you're based?
No, we were in London. And I was leading a very sort of complex life myself. You know, I was in business. I was trying to make money, trying to sort of create business and things like that. It was just, you know, it was a life which was very much around, obviously, family, but a lot of material sort of context. Mm-hmm. But I think actually that was the beginning of the of that feeling that life's got to be more than just a material context, because I think Laura became the insoluble problem or issue or opportunity, and that's where we started to understand that problems are actually opportunities. So she brought this other sort of aspect to our lives.
And then she went from the primary school to a mainstream school, or to a special?
No, to a, I think it was a Catholic school. It was nuns ran it. It was a great school. It was for special needs. And that she was never able to go into a mainstream school. But I guess the start in life at this fantastic nursery, Mrs. Myler's it was called, that just gave her skills which she wouldn't have had. And that's also quite confusing. If you meet Laura, you'll find she has great social skills and so on, but it belies the complexities that are behind Laura.
I mean, I wonder if you could go and tell us, it is very complicated, but what can she do and what can't she do? Give us an idea of her character.
Ah, okay. Well, she suddenly could sit there and have a sort of limited conversation with you, and you would say, gosh, she's very bright, but she wouldn't be able to process the sort of information that she's getting. So she has good days, and in good days, she's in a great place. She'll go swimming once a week. She does horse riding once a week. Key to all of that is that she needs to have a walk once a day. And in that walk, she needs to do it with somebody who is able to redirect her thoughts to keep her in a positive place. Because she can be quite destructive. She's great. She'll help around in the home that she's in, one of our homes where she's supported. She'll help in the kitchen up to a point. She'll do activities up to a point. And that's a good day. And on a difficult day, you could walk in and the furniture's being tipped over. She's not in a good place because her sort of frustrations have not been dealt with. I think it took Laura a long, long time for Laura to accept Laura. She understood that there was something different about her, which actually reminds me of something. When my son was 14 years old, Laura would have been about 12, and we were living in France at the time. And I remember him coming up and saying to Anne and myself, said, yeah, it's really not fair. You know, Laura's not doing the washing up. I do the washing up. She's not doing all of these things. And we actually had to explain to him, and you know, he's a bright kid, you know, actually Laura has disabilities. And that was a really classic moment when Hugo said that, because it just meant she was part of the family, and you didn't see those differences. You just bent, if you like, in your mind, or extended in your mind what normality meant, and so on. So Laura's very, very complex. She can, you know, she can be easily misunderstood overestimated and underestimated at the same time.
Yeah. I mean, that is a fascinating, very personal insight into that. And amongst our audience, there must be people that have got loved ones with disabilities, dealing with social care and that sort of thing. Chip in, put something in the chat if you want to ask Paul a question, because he's going to tell us how he managed this. And my next question to you, Paul, is at what stage did you realize that you needed to do something yourself to help Laura, and that you couldn't rely on social services or NHS and the rest of it?
Well, I guess, you know, we were always, you know, we were that group of parents who always had to fight and to get what Laura needed. It's not offered to you. We're very fortunate that we were articulate in being able to make those arguments. Came across a lot of people who were less articulate, less fortunate, and couldn't make those arguments. And it was a sort of combination of Laura going to college in Wales. She was in a community. It worked fantastically well, but then she actually outgrew the community. And coming into contact with other parents as well. And I think the key moment was, you know, if I'm honest, you know, I was saying to myself, well, what is the point of Laura? And, you know, this is a deep personal sort of insight. You know, obviously the point is that we've got to be able to support her and make her life work and so on. And I guess over a period of time, we suddenly thought, well, if we could do something, because her cottage was running out, we were down to the last 2 years, year and a half. And in those days, you could go for a much longer period than today. And the principal said, you know, you need to think about where your kids are going to go to from here, because there isn't something out there. And other parents who've come out of this college, who've had children here, have got together and looked at creating something themselves. So that was the beginning, really, where we were 20 parents when we did a sort of get together symposium to look at what could be done. But after a year, there were only two other parents. There was us and two other parents. And we started looking around and we just thought, what we saw was so disappointing, you know, and this is 20 odd years ago. It was so disappointing. And something in us said, surely we can do better than this ourselves. And at a certain stage, we met somebody who had four services up in Lincolnshire. And she was very convincing and we liked what we saw. But she said, you know, if you think you can do this as a charity, think again. You know, this is an all-embracing, very, very sort of complex thing to do. And at that stage, when we were thinking about a charity, we sort of pulled back. And then a couple of years later, my son Hugo was working with me. We were completing a development and he'd come from university. And we together sort of said, surely we can do something a bit more worthwhile than just building nice apartments for people and selling them and then moving on to the next. Why don't we create something really good for people with learning disabilities, for our daughter, his sister, Laura? And Anne, as a family, we got together and said, well, let's just do it. We must be able to do it better than other people.
Just to take me back to that time that you were looking around and decided that there wasn't much out there, as you put it, because in law, in this, you know, the state is meant to, or various people are meant to, you know, give what meet needs is the phrase, I think, that they use. What did you see that made you think the way you did?
Well, I suppose the first thing you think as a parent, if you look at the property, you look at the shabbiness, you've got the broken furniture, you smell as you look in, the sort of incontinence, all of those things. Now, I have to say that I think things generally have improved in most instances since those times. You know, we were in the late 1990s, sort of early 2000s. So I think we just thought, why don't we build really meaningful sort of environments for the long term? And then surely it would be easy to find staff, colleagues who could then sort of supply the services, which is how we started. What we didn't realize was that actually creating nice properties was the easy bit. It was the running of the services.
Yes.
Because yeah, we were faced with the systemic issues that exist within the sector. Roll back 23, 20, well, this is in 2004 that opened our first home. So, you know, roll back nearly 20 years and it was even worse than it is today, but it ain't much better today in many ways.
Okay, can I just feed in before we move on, because I really want to hear the creation of what you did. As Sarah speaks to us, I love the fact that Paul's enlisted additional help outside the family to support them and give Laura a sense of independence. What has she, her situation, taught you the most over the years?
Well, Laura loves to be the center of attention. She has a learning disability. I think it's true with most individuals. I don't want to say every individual, but most individuals, is about survival. It's about getting the things that you need to happen when you need them to happen. It's competing with other members of the family or other people within your care home, whatever the environment is, or supported living. So it's very me, concentric, basically centric. So it's all about Laura, and you have to recognize that. So when she comes home, she loves the one-to-one bit. She likes to be social when we go up, and once a month we'll go out with Hugo, with his children, our grandchildren. She likes that, but only for so long, because then she will want that sort of intricate one-to-one relationship. She has it incredibly strongly with Anne, because I think she feels Anne's need as a mother, which will always be there. And that underlying sort of vulnerability that you have as a mother, particularly, and I'm not saying fathers don't have it, but in my case, I realized quite a long time ago that, you know, Laura's an individual. I had to accept that, you know what, I have the limit. I'm limited as to how I can interact with her. I can interact with certain things. That's absolutely fine. But my role really, I felt, was to make sure that she has the right environment. So we'll have a great sort of interaction when she comes home for a couple of 3 days. It's great, but up to a point, because then at that stage, she's living two realities. She's living the reality of our home, which she's part of, and she's living the reality of her home. And that's quite conflicting, because in her home, everything happens the way she needs it to happen, when it needs to happen. In our home, it's very much around a family routine. So those are the conflicting things, and it can create a sense of, you can feel guilty about these things.
That is a really fascinating insight. And also, before we get to you building what you've built, you were dealing with medical professionals to make sure she was healthy, and I presume with social services or care professionals. Give us an idea, firstly, with the medical professionals, what your experience was.
Well, I think with the medical professionals, there wasn't really very much that anyone could do until the fact that, she used to have plaster casts on her legs in the early days, and then she had sort of built up soles and so on. But really, it was the scoliosis that she had that started to become more and more pronounced. We, in some respects, were very lucky, because I had that sort of midlife crisis at quite a young age. And as a family, we thought we'd go off to France for a while. We were slightly in love with the idea of a sort of sun, sea, that type of thing. But of course, it's very different when you get down there. But where we were very lucky was that we ended up in Montpellier, which is in fact a center of sort of medical excellence. And we went, and really what they had to offer at that time was far beyond what the UK was actually offering, quite by chance. And they had sort of relationships with Americans and so on. And what they tried to convince us to do was to have an operation for her scoliosis, which was a really complicated operation. It involved putting bars through her spine and stuff like this and so on.
Explain scoliosis quickly to those.
Yeah, it's sort of the bending of the spine and curvature of the spine. And she had quite a serious curvature of the spine. And we were told all these stories about, well, you know, if you don't have the operation, then she'll have problems breathing. She'll have problems with digestion. It's a terrible prognosis. So the whole medical thing was towards a medical solution. But we were really lucky, because at the time, she was wearing a corset at night and during the day as well to offset her spinal sort of curvature and allowing her body to do that. And it was very clear to people around that we were really against the idea of a medical intervention, but you know, we had to have those conversations. And this gentleman who made these fantastic courses, which just far exceeded anything that was happening in this country, he took us on one side and said, look, you know, if you really are determined not to have an operation, then I can build a corset for her, which would help her during her development period. And I think we really at that stage came to the decision that what happens if we have this operation and it all goes wrong? How's Laura going to manage all of this? And then you suddenly realize there's some things in life you can't fix, you know, and there's no way that in a conventional term could you fix Laura. It was all about managing, helping Laura to manage Laura's life. This was her life. And the idea of sort of having an operation and the fallout of that and how would she handle it. So we made the decision that we would do everything to not have the operation and to go with it. And, you know, 44 years old, she has not a great curvature, but it isn't a life-threatening one. It does mean, for example, that she has to go horse riding every week. She has to go swimming. And those are not things for her pleasure so much as for the muscular effect that that actually has.
And,
so,
and you know, do you still get the corsets made in Montpellier?
No, she decided when she was, must have been about 30-something, she said, you know what, I'm not wearing these anymore. Yeah. We just thought, you know what, nobody's going to argue with you. You know, I wouldn't want to wear them either. Yeah. So she went for along with it for as long as she could, and then she made it very clear. And you just think, well, this is Laura, you know, we'll help her manage what it is and let's not worry too much about the future and let's trust our good luck.
You said something very interesting there, so that you realize at some stage there are things in life you can't fix. It might seem like a cliche, but if you're leading, as you put it, in London, a successful life, building a business, property development and all the rest of it, when did you actually realize that for yourself?
That's a really good question. I suppose looking at my own life, I mean, I did property development, but at the same time, we had technology development. We were doing things. I was always ahead of what was possible. In the early 80s, we were doing telecommuting type center in Victoria. It got into terrible trouble with British Telecom and the security services and God knows what. And I started to realize, I think at that time, that the sort of mixture of my personality of sort of creativity on the one side and sort of business acumen on the other, which were always in conflict with each other. And it started making me realize, and I guess it wasn't really until I was in my 50s that I suddenly thought that actually I've had a fantastically interesting life. It's never gone quite the way I wanted or expected it to go, but I've always survived and I've always gained knowledge and things. And then when this came along, we tried to fix hair, but then we actually realized it was far more complex than that. So I think, you know, life's a strange thing. You know, don't say too many, it has to be this or it has to be that. Sometimes you just have to trust it and go with the flow.
And during that period that you were deciding Laura's future, you would have been having conversations with social care professionals. Tell us about some of those and how your realization dawned upon you during that time.
Well, I think it was a fight at every stage. We came back from France and got Laura into a special school, which was a battle, but it got funded. And then we got Laura into a college down in Wales, which was fantastic. It was a camp based on the Camp Hill principles. And so on.
Camp Hill is the community village.
Yes. It was great until she outgrew it. It was very craft orientated. It was house parents who, you know, it was all of those type of things, which were fantastic. But then Laura actually outgrew that and became a person. I think the worst stage was that she then moved into a supported living place and it failed within about a month.
Explain that phrase supported living to us, Paul, because these are stuff that you get in that thing. But
okay, well, if I explain a care home, you go to a care home, the property, the care, everything is just wrapped up into one. If you're in supported living, you become a tenant of a property, so the property is dealt with separately to the provision of the services. I won't go into all the reasons why that's evolved, but it's a good model for some people, not for Laura. She pulled it apart within less than 4 weeks. I think the problem then was that we'd opened our first home, and this was the most horrific situation, where I think the care manager decided she really didn't like us. It became very, very personal. So Laura was in sort of temporary type environment, which went on for about a year. And we said, look, you know, really she should come into our care, and now we've got them established. And what they did was they brought in advocates. And the advocates genuinely, honestly, completely manipulated the situation. And it was quite clear that the advocates had determined that we somehow were trying to make Laura do something she didn't want to do. And in the end, this was a horrible situation. We put in complaints. The advocate, you've got to be really careful about this because the advocate's independent. Excuse me, who was paying the advocate's fees? It was the local authority. So, you know, the advocate was not independent in this case, although they were still claiming that they were. But it took us into a most massive battle with the head of social care with learning disabilities and so on. And in the end, we just gave up and we said, okay, well, Laura's can move in. We couldn't argue that Laura's going to move into another supportive living place. And we said to Laura, are you sure you want to do this? And she'd been completely manipulated by what had actually happened.
So can I just sort of, because I want to get the picture, I think, is that she was in a supported living provision that wasn't adequate. But you mentioned your own homes. Had you started your own care home business at that stage? Yes.
Yeah. What had happened was she'd gone into a supported living placement. It didn't work. So she went into an environment where she could stay. It was a limited environment. But it went on and on. And the idea was that she should then go into a final placement. So basically, we got to the stage where the authority wanted to go into a particular home. Laura said she wanted to go into this supported living home. She didn't know what she was agreeing to. And then, so we gave up. But literally, the weekend before she was going to move in, my son took her off to Brighton, etc. And she just had a breakdown. And she said, I don't want to go there. I want to go into the home that you showed me and so on. And I think at that stage, to be fair to the local authority, they did back off and Laura did move. But, you know, it was outrageous the way that the advocates took control of the situation and essentially turned us against us by sort of just taking stuff that she was saying literally because she wanted to please them by giving them the answers she thought they wanted to hear. And then they used that against us and so on. So
that got to be very careful. We hear, you've used this word, fighting a lot, and we hear this in the social care thing, fighting to get what the state promises by law. What you've given us is an example of a big fight, is it? So the people that you're dealing with, the advocate and the social worker and whatever, that get up in the morning, go to work, take their kids to school, whatever they do, and that when they look you in the eye, which side of that is lying, cheating, covering up, whatever? Because you're dealing with more than just a sort of political debate here, aren't you? You're dealing with the facts of somebody's life and well-being.
I think there's two types of people. There are, we've come across them, some commissioners who actually, they don't care a damn about it. All they care about is the money. And that, believe you me, there are commissioners who literally just put it all out to contract department, and it's the contract department who drives it. And then you have, in fact, there are three sides, you know. Then you have, at the other extreme, on the good side, you have fantastic support. You have fantastic sort of care managers who absolutely get it. They want the best for their clients and so on, and they get the total environment and all of that, the family bit and so on. But then you get a sort of another group who sort of sit in the middle. And they are, we know what's best group, you know. The heck what you're saying as a family, we know what's best for Laura, yeah. And we know that what you're saying is not best for Laura, and we're going to prove the point, okay? That's what we were against. They used those sort of lying, cheating things. I'm not going to say whether they did or didn't. I have my very strong thoughts about that, but I'm not going to say. I've moved on in my life, although I would have told you a few years ago. But they genuinely, I think, somewhere convinced themselves or believed themselves that this was the right way to do it. You know, so it's a difficult one.
At what stage in this, because some of the way you're telling this story, you're sort of the objective raconteur, and the other way is you're a very passionate, involved father. At what stage in this fight, for want of a better words, did your sort of objectivity businessman stuff strip away and you felt the fury of a father in your heart?
I think you can feel, you could sum my life up the other way. You could say I was always totally emotional. I was always totally passionate. And it's only in my latter years that I've sort of allowed the business or the more structured side to have. Let me tell you, I was born a rebel and I will always live the rebel bit, except I don't feel I'm the rebel anymore. I feel I'm the person with a cause that's a proven cause and that we need to make this available to everybody. So we're on a mission. So I think that, you know, I have those I'm totally passionate and so on. I think I understand the bigger picture of these things. My naivety has sort of disappeared. I would like to think that I have a level of sort of wisdom that's come out of it, and that it's sometimes to win, you've got to harness that sort of, you've got to harness strategy. It becomes a different thing, but let me tell you, the fight is in there every day, you know. Whether it's the Care Quality Commission or other commissioners or whoever it is, you know, it's always that. But one thing I hate in life is the idea of unfairness. You know, unfairness is the thing that motivates me more than anything else in life. And that goes back many, many years ago. I think I was 5 years old. I was in nursery school, whatever. A couple of kids targeted me. We fell over. Somebody broke their arm. I got accused that it was my fault, and even my father and everybody said, you did this, and I hadn't done it. And I think that sort of sense of unfairness absolutely has always stayed with me. And it's about being fair and proportionate in life, you know. So when somebody is unfair, then, you know, I take them well.
And that's a great sort of a childhood experience that has embedded the passion and your moral compass, I presume. And I want to go back to you're having the fight with Laura, and you have also just started at this stage your own care home thing, which has become Home from Home. Tell us how you did that and why you did. Well, you've told us why you did it, but the initial stages of building what you've got now.
Well, we basically had investors who invested in our sort of property company, and we said to them, look, we're going to go into care homes. The overriding thing is that we're not going to compromise. We're going to deliver the best services, but we can't see that if you deliver the best services that somewhere there can't be some sort of commercial gain or whatever. Didn't quite work out like that. So we started on the basis, so we had people who lent us money. And Hugo, my son, we went up, we found them with Anne, we found the first property. It was a closed care home. We walked in, it still smelt and it just was terrible, but we bought it. And we then, Hugo and a laborer, started what then has become a 20-year development process and so on, where we ripped it apart. We decided, I remember the conversation, you know, what sort of doors should we put on? And Hugo said to me, why should we do different to what we used to do with our apartments, with flats that we used to build? Let's put oak doors on. Why don't we put quality that will sustain and so on? So we started to make our own sort of, if you like, our own investment, which went over and beyond just creating something, but putting some passion, putting some style, putting some quality in it. And that was really sort of the starting point. And then nothing worked out the way we thought it was going to be. You know, we were told, you know, get the home ready and the people will come. Well, actually, this was at the time that the big institutions had been closed, most of them, and suddenly the people weren't there. And we were in the wrong place at the wrong time in many respects. We were in Lincolnshire. And the whole movement was, number one, was that people shouldn't go into care homes. They should go into supported living. So there was a sort of prejudice against care homes. And number two, it was about the people should be supported in their own community, wherever that might actually be. So here we were with the home in the wrong place, but they were great looking homes. And at that stage, Anne opened her little black book, which was all the names of people that we had come across, you know, through Laura. And she phoned up and said, by the way, have you found any book anywhere for Charlie, Fred, and so on? And as a result of that, from nowhere, Anne filled our first care home, which was good because you had the second one coming on stream. And then that changed slightly. So we started to create a situation where if for somebody to get funding from outside of the county, they had to look around to see what was in the county, if that was Surrey or wherever it might be. And if it was there, then they had to be placed there. So we would only get the most complex people. And that was the beginning. So A, it had to appeal to families, and B, we would only get the most complex people. And so we started in 2004. And then came the credit crunch in 2007 and 8. And we had not got to that critical place of actually break even. We were still costing a lot of money to build it. And we went through a horrible stage where I think if it had been any other business in 2008, where the bank said, oh, you owe us X number of £1 million, we want our money back, you've got 21 days to repay us, except or send us 300,000 quid and we'll tell you whether we're going to put you out of business next month rather than this month. And that was in September 2008, when the whole credit crunch was starting.
Right.
There was no way that we, anyway, it was at that stage, if it had been a business venture, we would have said, you know what, we can't make this work. Here are the keys to 4 care homes, 5 care homes, whatever. Take them and good luck. But you can't do that when you've got your own child in there, your daughter, when you've got everybody else's children in there and you've got 100-odd staff. You can't do that. You can't run away from it. And I suspect in some way that's probably what I've done in life without necessarily realizing it, that you have to go beyond. You have to, in this situation, we were a hostage as family to what we had created.
But Laura is not in your homes at this time. She was somewhere else.
By 2008, she's been in our home. Yeah, she'd been in there a couple of years, I think. And it was always intended that Laura would come into one of our homes. But the first couple of homes we opened were for very, very challenging people, whereas we then opened something that was for people who challenged in a different way, and that which is fitting more Laura.
And so you were talking about the real estate, as it were, was the least of your problems, you said, and then you got the banks and the challenges. And then the regulators or whatever, you said that you came in at a time when it was going against institutions. Just explain that thinking to me a bit that they had and that you had at that time.
Yeah, I think that's a really interesting point. I'll be picking that up. I mean, you know, there was that horrible situation of institutions which had come all the way through. And then, you know, getting people out of those institutions. And these were horrible sort of things, horrible type of institutions that none of us would want sons and daughters. But the problem with the system is that, so they shut them down and they were encouraging people to go out into the community, which was absolutely right. But the problem is that that sort of branding of institution has never disappeared. So you can say, well, an institution is many people living together in one place, more than 6 people living together in one place, and so on. And so that got applied to other services, which actually had a level of scale, but they weren't like the old type of institutions. You know, like there were a lot of good places. Equally, those good places were not necessarily as good as they needed to be. So they needed to also undergo a change process. But what has really happened is that almost it's been, well, you don't fit this basic thing of so many beds, you have all of this, so we want you to shut down. This is not a good policy. What he should say is you need to find ways, and you've got a period of time to change what you're doing to make it more person-centered and so on. So what has happened is the system actually has shot itself in the foot, because on the one hand, and I will fast forward to Care Quality Commission. So on the one hand, they said,
which is the regulator for the industry, does it? Goes right into care homes and that and inspects.
Correct.
Yes.
Correct. At this stage, there's all sorts of warning bells going off around me, because as soon as I mentioned Care Quality Commission, I have to be very diplomatic about how I put all this, because the first thing to say is it's not easy. Okay. The second thing to say is that they're a regulator, and they are, if you like, saying these are the outcomes that we would expect. But it goes worse than that, because they say they became the shaper of the market. And this goes back to 2015, 2016, when we really ran into a big problem with them, where they are dictating at that time. They said, well, no home should be more than six beds, and there should only be one home in one place, and so on. And that is the problem. If you say, we want these outcomes, but you say you can only achieve these outcomes with this model of delivery, well, you're only going to get a certain type of outcome based on that model of delivery. What has to change is the model of delivery. So we got into really serious problems with them in 2016, where we opened an absolute state-of-the-art home. It had eight apartments, which were divided into four and four with a communal space, and each apartment was self-contained, and it was a care home, and it was for the most complex individuals. And we just spent a couple of million pounds on it. It was the best, probably in the country at that time. And we came to register it, and CQC said, well, we're not going to register it. We said, well, why not? Well, we said, they said, well, we brought out RRS, Right Care, Right Support. And it says, our paper, you shouldn't have more than six beds. You've got eight. You shouldn't have more than one home on a site. And you've got two other registered services. We're not going to register it. We said, well, hang on a moment. You know, what we've got is totally individualized services, apartments for everybody. You would allow us to run as a supported living model, but which we can't do because of the complexity of the people that we've actually got. And so on. And we went through a horrible 28-day period where we spent about £30,000 of legal costs and so on. And in the end, they said, we hate you for what you've done because you've involved families 6-9 months ago in getting ready to come into these homes and being able to tailor everything. That's all wrong. But we're going to register it anyway because we're going to let down too many people, but never, ever come with this type of sort of solution again in the future. So it was really unpleasant. But we actually, again, go back to my fairness, this little kid who got blamed for breaking somebody's arm when he was 5 years old and so on. I said, well, hang on a second. You haven't actually followed your process when you changed this RRS thing. And you didn't follow it. You didn't consult. They said we did. But anyway, we carried on the legal challenge. And in the end, we got CQC to agree that they would reconsult, which is what they did in 2017. But all they did was to double down on everything that they actually said. So what you've got is you've got a well-intentioned policy based on something that was far more relevant many years ago. And it's actually now really hindering the way that services are evolving.
And because you mentioned the six beds, eight beds thing.
Yeah.
These are arbitrary box-ticking figures, it sounds to me, that they have on their spreadsheets. But doesn't relate to the fact that you happen to have a property that's got eight beds in it instead of six. And therefore, they tried to, all the initiative, all the motivation, all the money that went in there, when the state was not supplying this stuff, didn't matter a damn to them. Am I roughly right on that?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, what they've done is they've sort of watered it down a little bit. They said, well, we're not saying now. They then came out with a new sort of policy, which was just the old policy sort of slightly modified. So they could say, well, we're not arbitrarily saying six. It might be a few more beds. And indeed, they have registered more beds. You know, but the fundamental thing has not changed, where it's so narrow what's happening. So The issue behind this, it gets really complex now, and I don't want to bore everybody, but basically the idea is everybody should be in the community. So the way you can define that easily is to say, well, everybody should have an apartment. If they're very, very complex, they should be in the community. Fantastic, great idea. But the solution that they see is that even if you're really complex, then if necessary, we'll give you your own apartment in the community and we'll stop it 3-1, 24/7 or 4-1, 24/7. And, you know, it's great. Now we've got them in the community. They're not in a care home. But wait a minute, you know, you're creating a sort of social isolation. You're having maybe three staff 24/7 or even in some cases four staff 24/7 because
for one person.
Because this individual When they get unhappy, will display complex behavior, and you need to restrain them. You know, so in a way, you're sort of, and again, you can't say this is true for everybody, but for a lot of people, this is true. You're almost sort of projecting this expectation of we're going to have to restrain you into the life of this person who's being supported, who's living a very isolated life. And by the way, those packages could be costing 12.
I was just going to, if you had four carers to one person, and one of them might need to be an expert in handling people, the other one might need to be an expert in behavior practices, the other one an expert in musical stuff or whatever, then you're duplicating, and I presume, or I don't know, in your things, you have a pool of those specialities that you can draw upon as and when needed?
Well, yes, I mean, that's the point. I mean, I think you're talking about quite a sophisticated setup, which you wouldn't have if you've got four people. The reason you've got four people or three people supporting is primarily that you need a number of bodies in order to be able to carry out a certain type of restraint. So sometimes this will work well because you'll have creative people in that team. But if you're really creative, you know, do you really want to be sitting around in a place with two other members of staff? Well, some people will. Yeah. So it's not a great atmosphere, and it's a very, very expensive service to deliver. And you're right. So we start from the premise that everybody gets an apartment. So you have your own apartment. Yeah. And then what we try and do is we say, well, those number of apartments, whether it's four or three or whatever, or two, they'll have a shared communal area. Okay, you have your own front door into your apartment, but you have two front doors. There's a second back door ready, which is actually into the communal space. Now, some people come in and we have no expectation they'll ever go through the back door into the communal space because they are incredibly complex individuals who do not want to share their time with anybody. But it's fantastic because you have that potential of moving through that door. There is a pathway and a way of measuring success, which is, you know what? So-and-so moved it. He was actually, for the first time in 4 years, he went through the back door into the communal area, and he was able to tolerate somebody else there. The fact that he had a couple of staff there all the time and the other person had a couple of staff, you know, it's what you need to do. So then you start to desensitize, which actually comes to the real key issue. Sorry, just there is, which is anxiety. You know, the anxiety that is what we often deal with and mostly deal with really complex people. It's the anxiety. You have complex autism. Your brain functions in a particular way. Your sort of look at the world is very specific, which says my world is this has to happen when it needs to happen at this time with that person and so on. So there's very little tolerance. And it's our ability to make what has to happen when it needs to happen with the right person by having all of these different members of staff in the background who somebody might plug in just for one shift, half a shift, a few hours, several shifts, might actually just plug in to go out and do activities and somebody else will be there and so on. That is what fundamentally reduces the anxiety of these individuals. So now they don't have to necessarily be physical towards their members because actually the guys who are supporting them can understand what they need in a much better way. So we make it happen. So actually, you know, somebody with complex autism, challenging behaviors are there as a way of communicating their frustrations and so on. So it changes very quickly.
You also have your own software, you were telling me before the show, that the social local councils and NHS do not have. Just explain that to me in a nutshell.
Yeah, I think it sort of goes back to 2008 when we realized we could never walk away from what we had, that we needed to create a system which we could still be there, but actually we could share the day-to-day bit. So in 2010, we started. We had this idea. We thought if you had a single platform, single login, and you had every single function that needs to happen, a software package all sat on the same platform. So fast forward, we have the most advanced technology in social care. It's the only type. It's the only one of its type. And I'm going on record as saying that because I'll challenge anybody to say that that is not the case. So we've built this platform, and basically anybody within our organization uses it, and what they see or how what they access and so on is totally dependent on who they are. So instead of having parallel bits of data, I mean, the NHS has so much data, it's unbelievable, but they've got so many different platforms. We only have one platform. If you have one platform, you can then see everything. So you can deal with the obvious things that the data tells you, but you then get into the subtle things, and you can then start to give each individual what we call a data voice, where the data starts to tell us they're not happy working with this member of staff. They don't like this particular activity, because you'll start to see their reactions. They won't complete it, or they might actually have some sort of issue, behavioral outburst. They don't engage, but you know, and so on. So you start to create this whole level of awareness.
And at how many people, these people with complex special needs, how many are you looking after at the moment in home from home?
Well, we have within our care homes, and we're not adding any more apartments as to our care home. That's it. We have 87 very, very complex.
87.
But to give you an idea of that, we have 500 colleagues, staff who support them. That's how complex they are. And from that, our currency of care that allows us to better understand, there's two currencies. There's 830,000 care hours that we deliver in one form or another, which we're looking at all the time.
Yeah.
But there's 80 million pieces of data that our platform generates. And so every interaction, what used to be a paper form where you put in information, everything is data. So we've got all this data, which actually we talk about problems and we talk about issues. What you're used to dealing with in care is the problem when things don't work and so on. Mm-hmm. We've gone beyond that. The problem we have realized is an amalgam of different issues. Something happened one day, 6 months ago, somebody turned up, somebody did this. It started off a chain reaction of events, and it was never got on top of. And those, if you like, that issue then amalgamated into the problem. Today, we are looking at all of these issues, and we have millions of bits of information. Now, some of those bits of information are telling us we have a potential issue here. This has not happened, and so on.
And
so
the other providers, for the other people that run these care homes, and there's, you know, hundreds of thousands of people out there in care, they don't have this technology?
They've got bits of it. But, you know, if I'm honest, it's completely crazy, because they're going it down the same cul-de-sac that the NHS has gone. And not just in healthcare, this is true in commerce. Couriers, you know, I mean, I know a particular courier, we had somebody joined us from there. They said, can't believe it. Everything's on one platform. We have five different platforms, you know, to look at it. So the problem is, at the end, you know, you have all this sort of, you've got all this baggage, all this old technology that you used at different time. To get off it is a nightmare, and to start afresh, which is really the only way. Because what it does is, Humphrey, you suddenly see that with all this information, the way you're structured as an organization, and particularly associate, you have a manager. A manager is responsible for everything. Well, imagine I've got a hope in hell of ever succeeding. You're responsible about 30, 40 different things. This way, we reduce down what the manager is directly doing to being on the floor. And then we have this whole team. We've got 35 teams plus, and they're all specialist teams who are looking at this data. They know what's happening in the care home in real time, and they're acting. They know that you're going to be short of staff tonight, so they're moving staff around. They know that you've got a member of staff who's likely to be leaving, so they're already recruiting a replacement, and so on. I had to go on about this, but it's a whole different thing. It's called the division of labor. And so we now get the best out of, you know, get best out of anybody.
The conversation, before I ask you that question, is it more or less expensive for somebody to be with you than to be with in their apartment with 4-to-1 or whatever? What's the difference in costs there?
Well, when you look at the most complex individuals that we're supporting, I would say that we're probably 40-odd% cheaper than putting somebody in isolation into the community. I mean, no care is cheap when you're looking at people. The cost of employing people, of training them, they stay with you for a period of time. Typically in our sector, there's very high churn rates, 35-37%. In our organization today, you know, we're sub 20% churn, because we have something like 100 different roles, you know. So which she wouldn't have in other organizations, because you would simply have managers who are really the top of the scale.
And against that supported living model that you said that fell apart so quickly for Laura, are you cheaper or more expensive than that?
Well, I think if you take very complex people, we will be cheaper in a lot of cases. I think if you put somebody with lower needs or inappropriately into our home, we would be more expensive because it wouldn't be the right place for them. So we have a number of people that we support who probably today wouldn't necessarily come into our services. But equally, we're not charging the levels for those guys. They're based on a historic fee. But sometimes we say, actually, it's time for this person to move out because we've done really as much as we can to develop this individual, and they would actually benefit from being in a supported living environment. So it's no one thing fits everybody,
yeah,
which is the problem in many ways with the way the regulators are going, because they are essentially, they'll argue otherwise, but the reality is they're creating a very limited choice of models to deliver the outcomes that they want.
And in your conversations with your peers in the care industry, are you an outlier, or are more coming along to your way of thinking, or do they hate you or do they love you?
I would say they think they're going to love us when they first see, they come and look at what we've got, very big brutes, they love it. Then they went away and thought about it, came back again, and then you wouldn't hear from them again, because this is a problem. Our organization is based on total transparency. You see everything, the good, the not so good, and the bloody awful, to be honest. But that is your incentive to deal with it. So therefore, you have to have collaborative working. All of your team, all of your staff members, their colleagues, they are part of the solution. Okay, so they all have to be involved in all of that, which means change management. You need a different way of structuring. And if they're actually involved in all of that, you are creating creative solutions all of the time, because mm-hmm. they come up with it. So you have to harvest that. That is a completely different way of operating.
Instead of crushing initiative, you encourage it.
Yeah, exactly that. It's a creative change management process, but it's happening all of the time. Not, oh, we'll go out and buy version 4. Whatever. No, this is just a continuous evolving process, which means you have to have a just culture, which means that if you are asking people to do things, to be part of it, to take measured risks, then you can't hit them on the head if they've done the right things for the right reasons and it's not worked out right. And as long as they put their hand up and say, this isn't right, then you've got to work through it. That's what the aviation industry does. And that's what we should be doing. And then the final bit is you have to create a sense of belonging and purpose, you know. So all of that means you have to create a culture. And that takes a long time to do. Okay, your private equity investing in these big groups, your management comes up and says, look, we want to bring all of this. So, oh my God, you know, that means you're going to lose money for a period of time or not make so much money when you bring in these changes, accepting it's going to be wonderful at the end, but no, shut it down.
I'm going to ask you to sit there for a couple of seconds because I'm going to tell our audience what is coming up next. Then I have a few cracking questions to finish with you, Paul, because it's a wonderful story you've told us. October the 5th, I think that is Thursday, isn't it? Lucinda is with the wonderful Rory Kevlin-Jones, who has Parkinson's and is the former BBC technology correspondent. That's a live event at the Riverstone Theatre in Fulham, London. And email Joe Carter-Hawkins at golster.co.uk if you want to come, or just say that you're a friend of Paul de Savarez and they'll let you in. October the 6th, I'm with AJ Chambers. That is a pseudonym, if ever I've heard one. His debut novel on the Troubles in Northern Ireland. October 12th, Lucinda with Jim Kelly, The White Lie, that's based on Captain Scott's last exhibition. October 13th, Lucinda is with Ruth Lee, A Great Deal of Ingenuity, a collection of Pride and Prejudice stories. That's all fans of Jane Austen's. And I just want to jump to November the 16th, where Bonnie Greer, who's the commentator and playwright, and a generally brilliant mind, is with Lucinda at the Rivingstone Kensington. And then December the 7th, we have Bonnie with my first ever Purpose, Passion and Grit guest, the Nigerian artist Lanre Olagake, live from his charity Arts Alive studio in Regent Street. Bonnie is going to interview Lanre, and then after lunch, the Golster and Rivingstone members are going to be in an art class with Lanre's students, who are mostly from the inner cities around Tower Hamlets and places like that. Paul, you have given us an incredible story here. You say you're not doing any more, that your 87 people are the limit. Are you going to expand? Are you going to put your model somewhere else?
The answer is yes. It's not that we're not doing any more. We've got enough with the personal responsibility for the 87. We've also got four living cells. That's enough personal responsibility. Absolutely. We're rolling out our technology, our platform, this new way of doing things, this holistic approach. And we're rolling that. We have a number of joint ventures with the voluntary community social enterprises, which is a huge sector. They're absolutely open for what we've got, because basically we're in for societal change. That's what we're about. You know, we think capitalism is the only way forward, but not the capitalism we've got now. This is greed capitalism. What we need is a much more benevolent capitalism that puts society at the center of everything that we're doing, because every one of us has a social care or healthcare story, you know, and I think collectively we need to come together and we can solve this issue. There's probably enough money in the system. It's just the system itself, the need for agility, et cetera. That's what needs to change.
We've got too many for me to read out. What an inspirational family, says Geeta. Wonderful guest, says Jean Joyce. An incredible story. Thanks, Paul. Sarah Speak, very insightful. Thank you both. Yes, you have given us a great thing. And one, give us in a nutshell, Paul, you've had many challenges in life that you've talked about. What is your advice to somebody who suddenly gets hit with a challenge that they're not expecting, life-changing challenge? They might not realize it at the time. They might be in denial, like you said. Give us a sentence of how they can handle it.
I'm an optimist. Optimism, the cup half full, always tainted by the cup half empty. You've got to be optimistic. You've got to believe that you can handle whatever's thrown at you. You can somehow get that state of mind, you know, even if it's a slightly delusional state, what you need.
Lovely. Thank you so much for that. That is it. Time's winged chariot has attacked us, and I'm not going to fight it. What an inspiring story we've heard today. Home from home, created from the love and need to care for a vulnerable daughter. Until Thursday with Rory Coughlan-Jones, stay active, stay curious, stay involved, stay safe, keep caring, and of course, stay Goldster. Thank you, Paul DeSavory, for sharing your incredible story with us. Thanks, Paul. Bye.
Thank you for listening. And find out our vast range on www.goldster.co.uk. Our vision is to help people stay stimulated, active, socializing, and empowered in what we say live happier and healthier for longer. The podcast is one of many strands, which includes nutrition, yoga, art, singing, languages, brain power, love, and many, many others, more than 300, all from the comfort of your home. If you like what you hear, please press that big subscribe button and tell your friends, family, colleagues, community, and yes, your enemies too, about what Goldster does. Spread the word about our incredible range of guests and subject, and until next time, goodbye from all of us at Goldster.